It is March 23rd, 2016. You're looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 635 of the Will Leach Experience Podcast on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. There are always, I think now there are four podcasts that we do on this show every year that I get particularly excited about. I get excited about all of them. They're all my children. I love all of my children equally. But there are four that I like more than my other children. And one of them is the one we just had with Matt Norlander. One of them is with Tommy Craggs, End of the Year. One of them is with Jeb Lund on Thanksgiving. And then we have this one, which is probably actually my favorite one because it involves baseball and my favorite baseball writer in the world, Joe Sheehan. So Joe Sheehan, author of the Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter, JB Sports Illustrated, and The Athletic to Chicago. You, of course, should be subscribing to the newsletter. If you're not, I feel like we can't be friends anymore. Joe, thank you for making your annual appearance to preview the season with me.
Yeah, you putting me with those three guys, it's like Dan Aykroyd showing up in the We Are the World video. I have no idea how you put me in with those three, and I'm quite flattered. Thanks, Will.
Oh, please. For the record, Aykroyd's got some pipes. all right, so a couple of we're going to do our regular preview. We'll go through every division and so on and that, but I want to talk generally speaking to a couple of the two larger things going on in a macro sense in baseball. Now, I say that kind of, I'm probably using too loose of language there, because really the largest thing in baseball is always, I would argue, I think you have argued as well, it's really labor management. That's really everything is all that story. But in a slightly smaller sense, clearly the thing that's happened, the ongoing narrative that's going on with Rob Manfred and the new and kind of his new push is toward pace of play. And you know, I actually was funny. I was on MLB Now actually the day that he had that. We're going to force this down the union's throat press conference thing. And I just happened to be on that day. I think they thought it was going to be a minor press conference, or otherwise they would have never let me be one of the people that was responding to it. Because to me, that brought the pace of play stuff back to, again, the larger issue of labor and management, and brought in the idea, like, I'm just going to do this. And so I'm curious what you think, just what you've thought. You've written about this a little bit. How seriously do you take the pace of play stuff? When you see some of the ideas tossed out, there's the inevitable, they're never going to do that. This isn't even baseball. But then they back off of it. I don't know what they're going to have. Do you think this is something that is truly taken seriously? And does it make you worry or not worry at all, or do you not care about what it does for the game that we all love?
I don't think the conversation is focused enough on what the natural length of a baseball game should be. And what I mean by that is, there's this idea, and I got into this with Brian Kennedy, this might have been even two off seasons ago, where he's talking about, 2.5 hour baseball games. And that's just a myth. I mean, to get back to 2.5 hour baseball games, you would literally have to put velocity caps on pitches and probably height and weight limits on players. Baseball games are 2.5 hours when you'd have five outs on the bases every game, sacrifice bunts and caught stealing and things like that. And hitters were going up there and swinging at the first fastball that they saw. The game's just not played that way anymore. I think the natural length of a baseball game, given the way pitchers pitch now with the increased velocity and more swing and miss and hitters trying to get in a good count and the increased amount of power in the game. And the natural number of pitching changes that you're going to see when pitchers are no longer expected to go 8 or 9 innings. I think the natural length of a baseball game is probably something 240, 250. And when I say natural, I'm talking about leaving about 215 for mid-inning changes. Because it takes time. Guys have to get out there and pitchers warm up. I mean, there's a certain natural break in a baseball game that happens in every half inning. So I think this idea that you're going to get baseball games back to 245, just doesn't accept the fact that baseball's just played differently than it was 25, 30, 35 years ago. You're trying to get back to this idea that baseball's going to be a 2.5 hour game. It's just not the way of the world. I'd like to see more focus on that aspect of it instead of batting gloves. There are people who think that if you just eliminated batting gloves, baseball would be a 2.5 hour game. They're wasting so much time. You know, something they're also playing for, a lot of money. If you've got a guy out there who just got called up, if you're Rob Refsteiner and you're trying to get, trying to keep your job in the major leagues, it's very important that you be comfortable at the plate, because every day you stay in the major leagues is worth a lot of money to you. And I think that we don't look at that enough. I mean, you see this at the back of bullpens now. You see a guy come in an 8-1 game and he's taking his sweet time pitching the ninth inning, and that's frustrating to watch. But for him, it's the difference between a $507,000 job and whatever the heck he's making per week in AAA. I'm sympathetic to the idea that the players have an investment here that the fans or the league or the media doesn't necessarily have. So I think there are things that can be fixed, but I think we're not kind of looking at the broader picture and saying, why are the games longer? The games are longer because baseball as a game is being played to a 240, 245 pace, which isn't being laggardly or anything like that. It's just, this is the way the game is now. I'd also add that, you know, we talked about this, I think it was 2 years ago. If baseball wants to cut down the time of game, it can cut the commercial breaks. And lo and behold, they did that last year. But here's the thing. Once you get to the postseason, those expand again. So when more people are watching baseball, the game is adding 20 minutes a night to their game times. So again, you know, are we taking this problem seriously when everybody's watching, we're literally adding, what, 12, 13% to the length of the game?
Yeah, and generally that's the same commercial, and it's usually about either boner pills or getting off of opium. So,
or somebody's selling me a car.
Yeah. So if it were only that, if it were only the cars, actually, that would be fine. Then my second thing is I wrote about this this week for Sports on Earth about what, you know, with all of this talk of baseball supposedly losing younger fans, and I think a lot of these things, there are figures on it. I think sometimes those figures are... if not, so I don't think there's not so much inaccurate as much as they are twisted to use the purposes of whoever happens to be making the argument. But I would say that clearly baseball has made shown that they want, they're clearly concerned about that. And they're clearly concerned about trying to bring in younger fans and not have too old a fan base. And for me, you know, one of the great things about this World Baseball Classic, and you wrote a great piece for your newsletter about I think you called a little bit of the World Baseball Classic a little bit of a half measure, and I think that's right. But to me, one revelation of this tournament, for whatever frustrations we may have about start times or some of the issues, it's really been a revelation, not just that you've seen Dominican players and Venezuelan players and Puerto Rican players get so actively excited, and it's been so much fun, it's been this outpouring of emotion. You've actually now started to see the Fuddy Duddy American team do it. And you know, we're recording this before the rest of you people will all know who won the championship game between the USA and Puerto Rico. But like, to me, those have been the two big stories of this tournament, have been those two teams. And it, to me, you know, I put this in the context of John Smoltz and how he said, well, they got to get all that enthusiasm out of their system before the season starts, and how that's exactly the kind of mentality that baseball needs to get away from. And I also think that that can help solve some of the problems, some of the pace of play problems and the younger fan problems. I'm curious, what do you agree with that idea that I say about the World Baseball Classic? And do you think, as someone, because again, even as with the enthusiasm I had about it, we've all seen about it, there's still people being like, yeah, but my guy better not get hurt. And listen, there's concerns about that. Like Didi Gregorius may have gotten hurt in the World Baseball Classic. Is there a way, do you think the World Baseball Classic is worth doing? Do you think some of the things can be taken away into the regular games? And if there's a way to fix it, how would you fix it?
Yeah, the best thing about the World Baseball Classic is the games, right? I mean, if you did nothing but watch the games, you tuned in for the first pitch, tuned out for after the last pitch, and paid attention to none of the other conversation, the World Baseball Classic is awesome. They say you get a higher level of intensity than you would normally get in spring training games. The players care. The atmospheres in some of the games are fantastic. There are other issues. I don't know that any – I don't think the pace of play issue – I don't think speed – you know, cutting – making the games go a little bit faster and getting them done in 250 as opposed to 305 is really going to bring an entire generation to the game. I don't think players showing emotion on the field is going to bring people to the game. I think it's good. I think baseball is fun. And this idea that you can't express joy on a baseball field is one of the most frustrating things about baseball. And I agree with you, Will. I think it's changing. I think WBC is advancing that conversation. I think in 10, 12, 10 years, half a generation, and a full generation, this stuff will be more accepted, and we just have to get there. But I don't think any of this is really going to change the fact that baseball is probably never going to be the big story in sports. It's probably always going to be, let's say always, who knows where the NFL is going to go, right? But I think that, you know, the NBA has made strides. It's interesting that I think it's interesting to contrast MLB, baseball and basketball. Basketball, the Stathead revolution in that game has made for a much more watchable, entertaining game, whereas the knowledge that we have about baseball now has probably made the game a bit more stagnant. It's the same thing. It's using data to do research and figure out how to optimize the game, but it's affected the two sports in different ways. Just to bring it back to the WBC, though, I think WBC is a good thing. I think it could be better. I would really love to see it get a better stage. I've written this week about how I'd love to see whether it's the quarterfinals through the finals or even just the semis in the finals happen during the All-Star break when baseball has a stage to itself. when people are expecting to watch baseball and care about baseball, and it's not competing with a whole lot of other things. I think you could really build up the WBC into something truly beautiful if you could just make that one move. Young fans.
Yes.
The single biggest predictor of whether somebody will be a fan of a sport as an adult is whether he or she played that sport as a kid. And there's your problem with baseball, and that kids don't play as much baseball as they used to. It's easier to play basketball. In large swaths of the country, it's more popular to play football. Plus, those two sports have greater access to college scholarships. Unless you're going to turn college baseball into a scholarship mill, and I don't expect that to happen, I don't know that that's going to change. Kids are going to play basketball and football because it's just easier and there are greater incentives to do those two things than there are to play baseball.
All right. Okay. So now we got that stuff out. Let's get down to the brass tacks of games. I want to go through division by division. I never like to start with the AL East because everybody always starts with the AL East.
You grew up in Illinois. I don't know what it's like in Illinois. I grew up in New York. It was always the AL standings were first and the AL East. And things, when I got to LA, if I remember correctly, when I first got to LA in 89, they actually did the standings with the West divisions up top. It was very strange. It was very disorienting.
I can say even in Illinois, they did not put the Central divisions. I guess the West.
It would have been the West ones.
Yes. But we're going to start. We're going to assume that the listener is someone traveling backwards through time. And therefore, because my favorite thing of Los Angeles was waking up, of course, back. These things that used to be called newspapers, and you would wake up, and the best thing about LA is you have all the scores.
Yeah, I loved that part.
That was so awesome.
I date myself in LA to when there was still afternoon editions of the papers.
Oh yeah, wow, that actually is before my time. But the Friday paper was always awesome because it always had all the big movie ads.
Yes, the calendar section.
Yes, so great. Okay, so we're gonna start with the AL West. We're going to start with the AL West. It's funny, you know, we've talked about tanking and the idea of teams, understanding that they're not going to win, kind of starting over, and how that's kind of efficient way to do it. And the Cubs obviously have been a great example of how that works successfully. And the Astros have too. And the Astros, to me now, seem like they're still a starter. I think they're still looking for a top-shelf starter, and that may be really difficult to come by because, as we've seen, there's just not a lot of guys out there. But to me, the Astros have done the really kind of the Cubs thing, the Cubs have done the Astros thing of having all this young talent and then being smart about how you supplement and make additions to it. I'm just actively excited, as long as he shaves off the Mark McGwire blonde beard, to see Carlos Beltran back in an Astros uniform around this lineup. To me, and maybe I'm incorrect, I'm curious your thoughts. I can talk myself into some certain teams, maybe wildcard contenders, but this to me looks like the Astros are clearly the best team in the division.
I don't know if clearly. I think this could be a pretty good three-team race. I think this actually would be the best divisional race, if the wild card didn't exist. I think you could have three teams that could win the division. I'm going to end up, I think, with the Astros for the reasons you talk about. I mean, that young core, Correa, Springer, Altuve, that they brought along, they accelerated their timeline this winter, and they did it in an efficient way. They brought in Reddick, Beltran, and McCann. They balanced out their lineup. They really had a right-handed leading lineup. They improved the team OBP. It's really going to help the offense. They could legitimately. We'll see what happens with Ulieski Gurriel. We'll see if McCann and Beltran hang on. But they could have nine average to great hitters in their lineup. And when you have an American League lineup that actually goes nine deep, when you can start a rally from anywhere, they could have – there's a best offense in baseball potential here. It probably won't get there. You look at the Red Sox, you look at the Cubs, the Astros probably won't get there. But they could have nine guys average or better, and that just really makes the lineup flow. I have the same concerns you do, though, about the pitching staff. I think we accept now that Dallas Keuchel he's peaked. He had that 1 year. The strike zone was pretty much, ankles to shoulders, and he was able to exploit that. And I think he's a high number three, low number two at best. Colin McHugh is a notch behind that. Lance McCullers is eventually going to be a reliever. I don't think there's any way you can project him to right now pitch 160 innings in a season. We'll see if he gets there this year. But there's just that lack of a true number one and even really a true number two. And did I just lose you?
No, I'm here. You're here.
Oh, sorry. So I guess somebody logged on. at the trade, they have enough in the farm system that should a Justin Verlander come available at the trade deadline or somebody of that ilk, they can go out and get him. And I think, like the Cubs last year, they're ready to take that step forward. They're ready to put their future into their present to say, hey, look, we're trying to win now. As a Sports Illustrated contributor, I think I'm contractually obligated to the Astros have to win the 2017 World Series. Oops, I mean the Dodgers have to win the 2017 World Series. It's like Jack Nicholson's, the two Colonel Jessup with the two. Yes. Why the two orders, Captain? Anyway, I think the Astros have to win. I agree with you. And again, talk about they are the mini Cubs in that they tanked. I'm sorry, there's no other way for it. They took the word for it. They tanked, and this is now the product of that tanking.
Obviously with all the trades that DePoto made this offseason for Seattle, you know, I like the urgency for Seattle. You know, it felt like just a year ago that Seattle, this is like, okay, this is their last run. They're not going to have any better shot than this. These guys are getting older, and they still are getting older. But it does feel, for all the trades that he made, this does, to me, look like a better team than last year. And I think, maybe an even odds bet, you know, this is now the longest playoffs streak in baseball. I don't know if they're going to do it, but it certainly seems like a team that has given itself a better chance.
I think they've improved. I like the Carnes for Dyson trade for both teams. I've been a big Jared Dyson guy, so I'm hoping this works out for the Mariners. They've gotten so I didn't like the Nelson Cruz signing 2 years ago, and he's given them two really good years. And they need Cano at, I believe, 34 to continue to hit. They need Cruz at 36 now to continue to hit. They need Felix Hernandez, who's young but feels like he's old, to bounce back and at least be a number two starter. They are relying on some fairly old players. All of a sudden, the Mariners' core got pretty old. I think the same questions you have about the Astros rotation are there in Seattle. What are they going to get out of Irukuma, who's also, 37 now? Felix Hernandez. Is this the year? James Paxton is one of these fantasy guys this spring. He's shooting up the charts. People are expecting him to take a big step forward. They gave up on Taiwan Walker, which I didn't really love that trade, but clearly Segura is an upgrade for them at shortstop over what they were getting out of Kettle Marte and other guys last year. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think they've improved a bit. What were they? 86, 87 wins last year. This is why I say it's a three-team race, because I think when you look at the baseline expectations of the Astros, Mariners, and Rangers, they're all within about a 6 or 7 game window. And once you're all that close, now you're talking about record in one run games and who has injuries and who makes the trade at the deadline. So they're all capable of winning this division. I just look at the Astros. I trust the Astros offense more than I trust the Mariners offense. I think there's more downside risk because of the age of the guys the Mariners absolutely need to hit.
Okay, look at the Rangers. I'm assuming the Rangers are your third team. It's strange, the team that at one point seemed to have all of these young players that were all just going to take over at once, and then some have fallen back, and then moons you might not have expected have taken a step forward, and it's really a lot of veterans that have kind of buoyed them anyway. I feel like of all the teams, obviously, I think they overperformed their Pythag last year a little bit, and that's gotten some people down on them. There's still a ton of talent in this team, and I will say that, like, for all the talk of their stadium and all the weird stuff, they're the ones that seems to at least have the most top shelf rotation pieces of those three contenders. What do you think of Texas?
Yeah, again, they did. They wildly outperformed. They had a ridiculous record in one-run games last year, even better than the 2012 Orioles. So you look at them and say, can they do that again? Excuse me, Will. No. I don't have a mute button, so
that's okay. That actually is going to serve okay to discuss the Padres later. We can just put that in right there.
Yeah, we talk about the young talent that was supposed to come through. I mean, Nomar Mazara got off to a great start last year. He fell off. Drickson Profar's career was derailed by shoulder injuries. Joey Gallo, they haven't really known what to do with. You know, they re-signed Adrian Beltre, so third base was blocked. They signed Mike Napoli, first base is blocked. They get Shinsu Chu, DH is blocked. Profar is now a left fielder. It's just, you're right. It's been a lot of the veterans that they've got away. They put a lot into trades. They traded a lot of prospects for Cole Hamels. They went out and they traded prospects for Jonathan Lucroy. So this is definitely an older team that, again, has pushed its window forward. And you mentioned the difference between them and the other two teams. They have Hamels, Darvish. And that's two starters better than the Mariners and Astros have combined. And I think the real question is going to be the back half of that rotation. You know, is this the year Martin Perez kind of steps forward to be a mid-rotation guy? And then, you know, are they going to get anything out of Tyson Ross and Andrew Cashner towards the back half of the season? Chichi Gonzalez, I believe, is out for the year now. He's got a UCL tear, or is he going to get PRP? Yeah. I don't think he's actually have surgery. He'll have PRP. So real questions about the back end of that rotation. What we know about the Rangers, though, is that, you know, John Daniels has definitely been willing to say, okay, we're going to make the big deal, whether it's for Kinsler for Fielder or trading for a Hamels or trading for a Lucroy. So, and they still have, you know, a good farm system. They traded away a lot of guys. They've promoted a lot of guys. I think Gallo and Profar are key for this effort. If Gallo gets left in Oklahoma City and hits, he's going to be a real good trade chip for them. If Profar hits, I think you'll see him put on the market rather than be, you know, left out left field all year. So the team most likely to improve itself in midseason is the Rangers.
And then we have the Angels. Four more years. Tick, 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 tick until Trout becomes a free agent, or more likely, they will have to make a decision one way or the other on what they're going to do if they do not extend him, which seems increasingly unlikely. And this team, I think among some quant folks, there's been some squint, and maybe the Angels on the margins have improved enough to contend. But are they still in danger of squandering? To me, this looks like a team that's still pretty much in danger of squandering yet another year of Mike Trout.
Yeah, and again, if not this year, then when? I will say Billy Epler, who has a mandate to try to win around Trout, but they're paying $55 million to Josh Hamilton and Albert Pujols this year, which, you know, yeah, kind of becomes a barrier to success.
Yikes.
He did go into the offseason, and he seemed to have a plan. In adding Danny Espinosa, Cameron Maben, and Martin Maldonado, they've really upgraded the defense at three spots. And you can say, okay, at least there's a plan. We're probably not going to be able to put, you know, offense is more expensive, but we brought in some guys who could be, you know, league average minus hitters, and then really be good defensive players. Maben, center fielder in his career, he's going to play left next to Trout. You put him with Calhoun. You've got Simmons and Espinosa up the middle. They even brought in Luis Valbuena, who's a third baseman, who'll play some first base for them, probably continue with Chris Krohn. This is now a very good defensive team, and you're going to need that because the starting rotation behind Garrett Richards isn't going to strike out a ton of guys. The bullpen, you know, isn't going to strike out a ton of guys. They are going to need to be good defensively. I can squint and see them as, you know, I think I'm going to have them 79-80 wins because I really do believe in the defensive upgrades. The key for them to me is Garrett Richards. A year ago, I had Garrett Richards winning the American League Cy Young Award. He made four starts. Right. He's back. He's mostly healthy. He's throwing very well in spring training. He's the only guy that they have who has the potential to be a front of the rotation starter. If Garrett Richards pitches to the level he pitched, what was it, 3 years ago when he made the All-Star team and he blew out his knee against the Red Sox, I think that's the guy that could put them over the top and put them into the wild card chase. The other problem for the Angels, of course, they're not the worst farm system in human history anymore, but there's not a lot to trade with if they get to July and they're contending. They just don't really have a lot to they can put on the market and bring back a starter that they would need. So they're at a disadvantage both in actual talent and potential talent.
And can you think of anything to say about the A's?
It is the closest thing to an expansion team I've seen in a while. I don't mean in terms of overall quality, but when you just look how it's assembled, it's a bunch of 28-year-old veterans. Like they brought in Trevor Plouffe. We've got Yonder Alonso at first base and Rajay Davis. It feels like an expansion team. It's both bad and not particularly watchable. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. I mean, obviously the A's are just waiting to figure out the stadium situation. And, you know, David Forrest and Billy Bean kind of have to just put baseball teams on the field until they get settled. But, you know, instead of worrying about four-pitch intentional walks, Rob Manfred really needs to be fixing the A's stadium situation.
Yeah, I love it. I love the expansion team. I expect to see, like, David Need to pop up there. That's a little old cut. Okay, now we're going to go to the National League West. Let's look at the West. It's funny, in any other context, you know, and you've written about this before, about how postseason success has become a perhaps sort of unfair barometer of team success. In any other context, if the Dodgers had any sort of postseason success at all, we would already be going like, wow, look at what they've done there. Look at what they've built there. Maybe there's something to this idea of like stacking all this talent and not worrying about getting and just like, you know, flooding the zone with these guys. But because the Dodgers have not had that postseason success, I think it's not really seen that well. But, you know, they have won, what, four in a row division titles, and they seem well-primed to win one now. Would you change anything about what the Dodgers are doing? Are there opportunities that they're missing, or are they just catching bad October breaks?
Catching bad October breaks. They're also catching bad breaks in the market. Remember, they took on a lot of money when Guggenheim first took over, they traded for Crawford, they traded for Gonzalez. They made some deals where all they did was take on money. If you remember that weird three-way Braves, Marlins, Dodgers deal from a couple of years ago, they'd certainly be willing to spend money. The problem they have is that if you look at the last couple of free agent markets, you know, they had that sequence where they lost Greinke because, you know, Jack Greinke is his own man and he just went to the Diamondbacks for his own reasons. But he did it after Price had signed, so the Dodgers were left with all of this money and no place to spend it. That's how you end up signing Scott Kazmir. It's been unfortunate for them that they have all the advantage at a time when free agency just doesn't give you access to talent the way it might have 10 years ago. But no, I like what they've done. They held on to Seager. They held on to Urias. I actually would have held on to Jose De Leon, but you understand their desire to go out and get a Logan Forsythe, who's really, you know, a 3-4 win player at second base, stabilizing the infield. But when you look at their core talent, you know, if you reduce a baseball team to one guy, it's Kershaw or Trout, right? If you had to say, give me a one-man baseball team, it's either the Dodgers or the Angels. If you make it a two-man team, who's got the best duo? It's probably the Dodgers with Kershaw and Seager. And then you take that out. I mean, the Dodgers just have a lot of raw talent. Now, is it in the form of a baseball team? Well, the corner outfield's a little bit shaky, but Cody Bellinger is coming up. Alex Verdugo is coming up. The Dodgers, in 2 years' time, could have this ridiculously Cubs-like offensive core that's just a whole bunch of arm and pre-arm players that are able to put up 800 runs in a season. And I think that's the exciting thing. I think the Dodgers' patience and their lack of panic over the last couple of years of postseason results has been very impressive. And I hope they continue it. I mean, that can change on a dime. And you lose again in the NLCS to somebody, you decide you have to go out and make changes. But right now, I think they've executed this plan beautifully.
Yeah, maybe they'll pull off the Boston plan and just have someone that's really prudent and smart for a long time. Then they'll fire that guy, then they'll bring in someone that is
trading. Right, and then that guy can trade away all the prospects and still not get out of the first round of the playoffs.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so you can tell, I don't know if anyone's noticed, I've been doing these in the orders of my personal predictions for each of these divisions, which is where I come into my weird pick, which is number two, and a team I actually have as the second wild card this year. I think that if it hadn't have been for one signing, Colorado was starting to become the fun team this offseason. They're starting to become the team. You look, there's a ton of depth in that lineup, and the rotation no longer seems like – you can at least see something potentially in the rotation. The problem is when they signed Ian Desmond, which I agree is a somewhat inexplicable move, even though it was before he got hurt, which of course they couldn't have anticipated. It was kind of a fluke injury. But I think everyone was like, oh, yep, same old Rockies. Forget it. Never mind. I still look at this team. Yes, they would look a lot better with Edwin Encarnacion at first base rather than Ian Desmond or whoever replaces Ian Desmond. But I still look at this team, and there's a ton of talent there. There's a ton of offense. They've actually hung on to a lot of guys, and that rotation looks just enough to me where we always talk about the Marlins back when before Jose Fernandez's accident where – okay, this team has these two guys. They just need to be average everywhere else, and they're a wild card contender. To me, this offense, and also really the defense is not bad either, is that's enough that their rotation just needs to be not typically Colorado bad, and I think this can be a wild card team. Am I crazy?
Those are two different issues.
yes.
I like to think in terms of five-man cores, and sometimes it's six and sometimes it's four, but I'm with you in the sense that if you look at the Rockies core, Arenado, LeMahieu, Gray, Story, Blackman. That is a competitive core. That is a good – if you can put 20 average-ish guys around that roster, that core, you can be a wild card contender. There are a couple of things in play here, though. The 20 guys around them aren't that good, and it's a really badly run organization. The mindset where you get to signing an Ian Desmond to a five-year deal to play first base for you, or maybe play first base for a year and then move to the outfield, that's just a – That's not a decision that you make if you know what you're doing. Especially when, as you mentioned, there's an Edwin Encarnacion in the market who eventually signs for fewer years for less total money.
But other than that,
Mrs. Lincoln.
Oh, he would have been so fun at Coors, too.
Oh, my God. He also would have been fun in St. Louis. Can I get you teed up on that?
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. But I agree with you. I think the rotation has promised. John Gray, if he was anywhere but Colorado, would be getting a lot more attention. This is a guy who might be successful within Colorado. Bud Black is interesting. One of the things that we talked about with Black in San Diego a lot was the bullpens that he could put together, but it was never clear whether it was Bud Black can put a bullpen together, or playing in San Diego can make any collection of live arms look good. We're going to learn this year. There's live arms here. Adam Ottavino with that funky motion has been very hard to hit. Jake McGee was a power arm in Tampa who just hasn't really worked out so far in Colorado. I mean, there's some live arms here. But I think it's going to come down to the fact that this will sound crazy. The offense isn't good enough. If the Rockies are ever going to win anything, or when they're going to win again, they basically have to lead the league in runs scored. They have to have not a good offense. They have to not score 5.5 runs a game because, well, they play in Colorado. They have to legitimately be the best offensive team in the league. And this team isn't that. I love David Dahl, but David Dahl can't stay on the field. First base is now, quite frankly, going to be a below average position because Ian Desmond is just not a first base bat. We'll see what they get out of store. Injuries were a big issue for them last year. We'll see if they can stay healthy. Already, Tom Murphy's out. Ian Desmond is out. David Dahl's out. So the idea that they're going to be a second wild card, I think, is predicated on that things are going to go right for them, and that hasn't happened so far. I love the core. I just don't think – and as a guy who has another team in the NL West as a surprise team, I don't think the Rockies are good enough.
Intriguing. Okay, we'll go to my next team. My third-place team are the Giants. My issue with the Giants is it's funny. Let's say the Giants had not made these crazy World Series runs with teams. Like, I think it's funny. Was it last year where the Giants were terrific in the first half? And there was that notion like, wow, is this team better than actually all three of the teams that won the World Series? Because they were never going into those series thinking, oh, like the Giants are obviously the best team in baseball, obviously the favorite. Imagine they don't have those runs. They're like the Tigers right now. They're like the Tigers in that they're this really frustrating team that's getting older and never quite broke through. But because they won those World Series, it really got kind of forced in the World Series. We don't think of them this way. But this to me, like obviously there's solid rotation stuff there. But again, those guys getting older, every year it feels like one of these years Bumgarner's going to have, like, it's pitching. It's really bad in your arm. He throws so many innings. It feels like he's going to have to stop at some point. This team looks, my argument against the Giants, they look more fragile to me than I think that we, because we're used to the Giants being this solid team. They look a little older and more fragile than I think they're giving credit for. Am I being insane in that regard?
No, I mean, I think you look at that outfield, and that could be one of the worst outfields in baseball. Denard Span, now 33, might not be a center fielder anymore. I liked the signing at the time. It didn't really work out for them. Hunter Pence has started to break down. Left field is one of the worst positions in the game, with Jarrett Parker and Mac Williamson kind of might be a platoon, it might not. Edwin Nunez, they traded for last year. Edwin Nunez is a utility infielder who now is their starting third baseman. Mm-hmm. Their core is still good. Belt, Crawford, Posey, Bumgarner. I love the rotation. Bumgarner, Cueto, Matt Moore, which was a trade last year. But again, you talk about organizations. And Brian Sabian, who we thought of as an idiot for a long time and then we thought was good because the team won, decided to spend $60 million on Mark Melancon. If there's anything we know about the modern game, it's that relievers who don't have massive – who aren't Kenley Jansen or Aroldis Chapman, where they're striking out 45% of the batters they face, are common. And as good as Melancon's ground ball rate was, and as well as that matches up with the Giants infield, I just don't think that was a good use of $15 million for a team that has all of these other holes in the lineup. They needed probably one more hitter. I have them as a wild card. There's a real jumble in the National League, Will. I have to sit down. I really have to sit down. I think I'm going to end up with basically like six teams between 84 and 87 wins. And Giants will be one of those teams.
Which is basically what we had last year.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it's going to look a lot like that. And again, you're coming down to, okay, who has the big injury? Who gets the random, Gary Matthews Jr., Corey Lytle type performance, rest in peace, Mr. Lytle. Who's going to make the big trade deadline? I don't think we can say here now what's going to determine separate the six teams that are in the hunt for the wild card. But I agree with you. It feels like the Giants might have peaked. But at the same time, if they were to turn around and win 91 games, win the wild card, even beat out the Dodgers for the division, would you be that surprised?
I mean, listen, imagine they hang on to that lead in that Cubs game.
Right.
In game four. To be fair, there are like eight or nine self-protecting Will Leach. What would have happened in this playoff game if this would have gone here in the Cubs thing? So that's just, there's a lot of those.
They were destiny, Will.
Yes. What if Montero doesn't hit that ridiculous grand slam? Don't give me, I'm going to let it go. Okay, I'm totally not going to let it go, by the way. All right, so I'm assuming the next team is your surprise team, and I can see where you're coming from on this. The team that was an abject disaster, some reason reasons their fault, some reasons not their fault last year. It does seem like some of the pieces that they lost last year are back this year. Tell me why you're up on the Arizona Diamondbacks.
From memory, you're not a big fantasy guy.
I play it poorly.
Okay, that's how I play it. There's this concept of the post-hype sleeper where a prospect gets a whole bunch of hype, doesn't work out, and then 2 years later you draft him. And to
that's a Corey Schwartz idea.
I thought it was mine. I wrote about it, and like 17 people came and said, apparently it was in the Book of Job. So
yeah, it's possible that you wrote it, Corey Schwartz, in the show, and I just heard that.
Corey has no original ideas.
Yes, it's true.
No, I love Corey. The Diamondbacks, obviously, last year got a lot of hype. They made it really – Statheads knew it was a bad winter. I think the mainstream kind of thought they had a good winter. And, of course, a lot of things went wrong. A.J. Pollock got injured right on the brink of the season. Zach Greinke got hurt during the season. Some of the young pitchers didn't work out. Paul Goldschmidt had, for him, a bad year. Just a lot of things went wrong. And I look at them this year and say, okay, bounce back from the core of Pollock, Goldschmidt, Greinke, and there was a fourth name I'm forgetting. I'm sorry, I apologize. And then you look at Shelby Miller. Shelby Miller.
He's looked good this spring.
Those guys alone should be 6-7 wins better this year. You look at guys, Jake Lamb developing. David Peralta, if he's healthy, you put Peralta and Pollock in the outfield. It almost makes up for the fact that you've got the statue of Yasmani Tomas left. There are problems here. The middle infield's actually pretty bad. But I look at the core hitters, and I love the Taiwan Walker trade for them. I think they traded Segura at the right time. They got Walker at the right time. I'm a big Robbie Ray guy, and I'm not the only one. I think Miller's going to bounce back. You now have a five-man rotation with Corbin in the five spot where everybody could be average or better, and that's not easy to do. I think the real key for them is, can those five guys make 150 starts? And we saw with the Mets last year that if you've got a young, exciting pitching staff, it doesn't always work out. But I'm seeing the upside with the guys. And don't be wrong, I see the downside. These guys could get hurt. Ray and Corbin could take steps backward. The bullpen could be an absolute disaster. And they could win 74 games again. But I just look at this team. Like, everybody's kind of looking away from them, looking at teams like the Rockies, like you say. And in a muddled NL wild card, if they can get to 86, 87 wins, I think they get there. Plus, and I might be overrating this, they have upgraded the management team. They've gone from Chip Hale and Dave Stewart to Mike Hazen and Torey Lovullo. And I think there's going to be some value in just making that upgrade.
All right. Then we have, I would argue, the one team, even with all the tanking going on, the one team that looks most likely to actually make it down to 100 losses, San Diego. We've talked before, and I think I've read around a bit about how this theoretically the timeline's not working out perfectly for San Diego, because we touched on Oakland briefly earlier, but one of the things that Oakland has going for it this year is there is this sense, obviously they're still trying to figure out the same situation, but because the Warriors are leaving there and that the Raiders are gone or are going, and there's a sense that the A's this year are trying to market themselves as Oakland's team. We're the ones that are here. We've desperately been trying to leave for 15 years, so pay no attention to that. But we're the ones that are here, and we're part of Oakland. And San Diego seems like they would have that opportunity. Unfortunately, they seem to be at kind of a historically bad season that I have coming up.
Yeah, but you live in San Diego.
I know. I can't
feel that bad for San Diegans. They live in San Diego. Yeah. Just go to Pacific Beach, have some good food. I agree with you. I think there's an opportunity here for we don't have a lot of one team cities anymore. And I don't have a map in front of me, but a team where like the baseball team can be the only team in town. The Padres have that opportunity now. It's going to take them a couple of years. I will say this. The Padres are probably as sensitive to team success, or I should say the market is as sensitive to team success as any in baseball. When the Padres are good, they fill that ballpark. They used to fill Jack Murphy, and now they fill this park. So when they're good again, which is probably going to take a while, they will have a chance to own that town. I mean, I guess the San Diego Gulls, the hockey team, AHL team, is the second team in town, unless you want to count San Diego State. And I mean, San Diego State's going to have an opportunity here as well, but the floor is yours. You are the major sport in town. Spend some money, put a team on the field and try to contend. I think we're 2 years away from seeing that here. And it's like the A's. It's not that it's just a bad team. It's kind of an unwatchable team.
Jared Weaver.
My God. Jared Weaver. I mean, you're going to see cars on the 405 going faster than Jared Weaver's fastball. It's really, really ugly. But it's, like I say, I'd still, if you said Joe, here's a free weekend somewhere to go see a baseball game, I'm probably picking San Diego.
Yeah, I don't. It's hard to argue with you there. Okay, now we're going to move over to the AL. By the way, do you have an actual winner? Have you picked a winner of your three teams there that are kind of jammed in there?
I'm gonna end up picking the Dodgers, but I'm almost certainly gonna have the Diamondbacks as the wild card. Okay, one of the wild cards.
Awesome. Okay, so we go to the AL Central. The AL Central was funny. Last year, when I previewed the AL Central, it really felt like it was a scramble of where the teams were going to finish 5-1. You know, the Minnesota had been coming off a surprise wild card contention, and the White Sox seemed to at least be trying to make one last run. Cleveland had some issues, and the Royals were the defending champs. And this year, I feel the exact opposite. It feels like there is one team that is worth watching in this division, and everyone else are on different kind of runs of the contention the contention carousel, as Don Draper might put it. That's Cleveland. Like, to me, is there any way anybody challenges Cleveland in this division?
Oh, sure. I mean, I can make a case for the Tigers where they have one last run. I mean, this was really last year for them, but, you know, everybody kind of continues to fight off age, and Kinsler, Cabrera, Verlander, all are, you know, they're worth 15 wins combined, and they figure out the bullpen. I can make a case for the Tigers. Probably can't make a case for anybody else. Sorry, Royals fans. But yeah, I could see the Tigers with the last gasp at contention, but I'm with you. I think there's probably 7-8 game gap between the projected Indians midpoint, the projected Tigers midpoint at this point. You mentioned last year, I don't think any of us expected them to score as many runs as they did. And that was getting, what, 14 games out of Michael Brantley. Tyler Naquin, for all his foibles in center field, was an important bat for them. Jose Ramirez turned out to, he's tremendous development. Francisco Lindor hit. And we talked about this a lot during last year's postseason. The Indians have done as good a job as any team in baseball at turning prospects into players. If you look at this team, it's basically all homegrown, or it's guys that they traded for when they were younger prospects like Kluber. But they've taken all of these guys that have come into their organization and turned them into major league players. That's a really great skill to have. I've talked with you in the past about the Cardinals' ability to do this. Take these random guys like John Jay and get good performances out of them for $500,000. And I think you look at the Indians right now as this incredible player development success.
Okay, so it's funny too, because one last thing in Cleveland, because to me, they look like they looked so much better on paper now than the team that had the playoffs. Obviously, Carrasco's had some injury issues too, but, like, you know, it's weird to think of some of the players that were starting games for them in the playoffs. And now they just look more solid across the board. It feels like they saw their holes that were kind of exposed in the postseason, still kind of got through them, and proactively filled them in a way that I would argue some teams like my own, I would have liked them to have done more so. They seem very strategic and smart in how they kind of handled stuff this offseason.
I think the Fighting Keith Wolners are as good as it gets. No, you're right. They brought in Encarnacion. Even like a Boone Logan signing. They only had one lefty in the bullpen last year. You might have heard of him. Tall guy, throws a big slider. But when they used up Miller, it left them without tactical left-handers. And I think adding Logan as a loogie, they made these little tacticals. Now, center field's still an issue. We'll see if Abraham Almonte gets some playing time out there. But, you know, you look at last year's trade for Brandon Guyer. That was the perfect guy, exactly what they needed. So I think they've got depth. I think any team with starting pitchers who we don't know to have great endurance, you worry about a little bit. Remember, Carrasco's injuries last year were an arm injuries. He took a line, you know, ground ball off the thumb right at the end of the year that knocked him out of the playoffs. I like this team. Starting pitching depth, there's nothing there. We know they probably can't do a whole. They still have Bradley Zimmer if they want to make a trade at the deadline. But what you see now is probably what they start the postseason with. So, you know, we'll see how it goes throughout the season. But I don't think they're going to be – as much as they make the case for the Tigers, I don't think they're going to be challenged.
Okay, so it's worth knowing that my second-place team here is not a team I think is even really contending for the wild card. You should know how low I am on the rest of this division. But I will say that, like, generally speaking, I find myself always – the competitive carousels. I feel like judging that is as much as really is predicting team success in a lot of ways. You're finding out where they are. Chicago, we'll get to them in a moment. Chicago clearly, like, completely starting over. And Kansas City, really close to just kind of pushing that button. Detroit, barely kind of hanging on. The team that I find myself getting excited is too strong of a word for it, but one that appears to be at least on the come a little bit, one that I'm excited to see if they can put some of the pieces together, is Minnesota. You know, you look at but the obviously Buxton has not put it all together yet, but you clearly see some of the stuff he's capable of. It feels like more than any other team in the division, obviously Minnesota lost a lot of games last year. I don't think they were as bad last year as they played, in the same way they weren't as good as they were 2 years ago. I can squint a little bit and see them not as a contender in this division, but is there a way to squint and see them as maybe close to a 500 team?
We talked earlier about the A's and Padres being both bad and unwatchable. The Twins might be bad. They'll be better than those teams, but they're as watchable a team as you're going to find in baseball. I mean, if you haven't seen Byron Buxton play baseball, he's one of the fastest guys in the game. He has raw power to spare. He's a plus defensive center fielder because of the speed, tremendous arm. I mean, this is a toolbox who's becoming a baseball player. Miguel Sano is a beast, just incredible raw power, probably a future DH. They finally moved him back to third base. He played the outfield for I don't remember how many games last year, but it was not entertaining. Jorge Polanco's up to play shortstop. You've got, you know, they signed, I'm not a big pitch framing guy, but they signed one of the better pitch framers in Jason Castro. You're hearing good things this spring about Kenneth Vargas, who's going to be their DH. It's a watchable baseball team. And actually, in the second half of last year, they actually had a very good offense. So, you know, if I've got to choose between what kind of bad team to watch, give me the one that's going to lose 6-5 versus the one that's going to lose 2-1. At least the games will be a little more entertaining. They still haven't built a pitching staff. And it's going to take them a lot of time to get to a point where they've got a real pitching staff. They're still futzing around with veterans like Santana and Santiago and Hughes. So they're not ready to contend. 2 years ago, they got off to that great start, which was really a stone fluke if you dug into it. They ended up with an 83-win season, but it wasn't anything like that good a team. I think that made last year feel more disappointing than it actually should have been. They were never as good as they looked for the first half of 2015. But they're on the right track here. Again, another one of these teams with new management, bringing in the new ideas. I don't want to say they're starting over. They're not. They've got part of their future core in place, and we're going to see some of, you know, as we go on here with Nick Gordon and eventually, you know, a guy like Steven Salvis. But they're on their way. And I think if you've got to pick a team that's going to be good in 2019, I'd probably get on the Twins right now.
All right, my third place team I have as Detroit. You discussed Detroit a little bit earlier. Obviously, there's a lot of talent on this team, but my general thing with Detroit, other than, say, like Justin Upton having kind of a down year, though I think he came out a little bit in the second half, it feels like a lot of things went right for Detroit last year in a way that you – it's for a team that's older and you know, getting old, like perhaps the oldest team in baseball at this point, it's hard for me to project them to just kind of hang on. You know, there was a stretch where we thought when they made the Maven trade, you're like, okay, is this team, are they breaking it down? You heard they were listing on Cabrera and listing on Verlander. That seemed to not happen. I think obviously with the death of Mike Ilitch, so that seemed to be kind of pushing their timeline for a long time. Where do you see Detroit? Can they hang on enough to give it one last wild card run in July, August, September? Or are they at the point there where you're like, where they're like, okay, this clearly it's time for us to start this over. We gave it a shot, but now we have to do it over. What is it? Do you think they could get to that point this year? Or do you think this team is closer to at least making that one last run?
I think they're, because of the age of the team, and they didn't trade away Kinsler or J.D. Martinez in the offseason, they're, while they're not willing to add resources, they're looking to play it out. And they're kind of in that middle range where you don't want to be, where they're probably between a 78 and 83 win team. And they need everything to go right, which means this J.D. Martinez injury isn't really going to help them. They have no outfield depth at all. They really don't have a center fielder. They brought in Mickey Matuk to replace Maben. I mean, Tyler Collins is out there. He's not really a center fielder. Jacoby Jones can't hit at all, and he's in the outfield mix. It's a thin team. They need their top 10, 11 guys to go off. So an injury to Martinez is the kind of thing that really puts them off schedule. Again, I can absolutely see an upside here. Where you can't see an upside for some teams that are in this kind of range, you can see an upside where Cabrera, who's an Inner Circle Hall of Famer, Justin Verlander, who's one of the best pitchers of his generation, these guys all hold it to Ian Kinsler, who, being a peer of Dustin Pedroia and Robbie Cano, it's kind of blinded us to that Ian Kinsler is kind of on a – if he has kind of a late career push here, he's actually a fringe Hall of Famer. Yeah. Like, he's a very good player.
He kind of has that Jim Edmonds problem of playing at the same
time. That's a really good comp. Yeah. That's a really, really good comp. And that's – so, yeah, I see – the second best team in this division, because somebody has to be, But when you look at the wildcard contenders in the West and the East, it's hard to see them pushing past them.
And then you have the Royals, who seem to be in a transition year no matter what. And then obviously the tragedy of Jordan Ventura. With all the free agents that they have, I got the trade for Soler. I understood what they were doing there. I feel like that's the type of thing that we should get used to the Royals doing this season, because it's hard to see them contending in July. And at that point, then you'd have to think, with a team that won a World Series and therefore has that, they can always point to that, and they'll always have that. It feels like that's the time we're going to have to start making some pretty hard decisions.
On principle, trading 1 year of a reliever for 5 years of control of a right fielder is the kind of thing I'd be behind. I didn't understand it from the Royal standpoint, just because so much relies on their being good in 2017, because they are not going to be good in 2018. And then for them to lose Ventura, obviously, it's not so much that Ventura had been an ace for them, but you lost the potential that he takes the step forward and gives you, in Duffy and Ventura, a 1-2 that actually does make you a contender. It makes you better than people thought you would be. I think Pecota had them at 22, 23 wins. Something like that. I did KC Radio Tuesday, and I think I said 78 or 79. And I should mention here that I do my actual runs scored, runs allowed, wins and losses. I still haven't, I gotta sit down with the spreadsheet and do that. So I'm talking to you before I've actually done that. But I think the Royals will be below 500, but not by much. I don't believe in the Royals. You know me, I don't believe in the whole Royals magic nonsense. And one of the key things here, and I want to say there was Jeff Sullivan, or one of the smart guys at Fangraphs, wrote this winter. It's like, the Royals aren't the Royals anymore. Their defense is aged. They've gone out and acquired guys like Soler and Brandon Moss, who 2 years ago we were hearing, well, we can't hit for power in Kauffman Stadium. And you've done nothing but pick up these fly ball guys who have no skill other than really hitting home runs. So we'll see how this plays out. But I do think, as somebody who was a Royals agnostic during that whole 3 year run that they had, I do think it's funny that they're running away from the whole, we reinvented baseball thing. They didn't reinvent baseball. They just had a year where they had the greatest strikeout rate ever and an amazing bullpen. And now they're just like everybody else. And, God bless them. Flags fly forever. But I do think the conversation around the Royals was always more interesting than the team itself.
That's totally fair. And then that leaves us to the White Sox, a team that is really the only two questions to me that seem interesting about the White Sox this year is what is Moncada going to look like, and when are they going to trade Quintana? Is there anything else?
The development of some of the young starters, Carlos Rodon, Carson Fulmer, eventually Lucas Giolito. I mean, that's where the future lies for this team. These guys, these young, controllable starters. So if those guys all were to show up, pitch well, I mean, this team could be better than actually. It's going to be hideous offensively. I was talking to a friend yesterday and realizing that Cody Ashe is their DH. And Avisail Garcia is still around. Apparently just looking like Miguel Cabrera gets you a job forever. It could be a really bad, hard team to watch. What are they getting? You mentioned Quintana, also Robertson and Frazier. Like, Rick Hahn made that big deal start the offseason, and then kind of packed it in. But he's still got some work to do. This rebuild is not done yet. And you mentioned Moncada, the strikeout rate is everything. Is he going to knock the strikeout rate down to a point where the bat-to-ball skills and everything else plays? Because he's still in that range where he could strike out enough to just eat the entire offensive profile. But obviously, that's the excitement to come. If you look at Moncada, Rodon, Fulmer, Giolito, Zach Collins, especially if he stays behind the plate. I mean, that's a core you can build around in a couple of years. They've done some good things.
All right, so now we'll go to the National League Central. Clearly, there's a clear favorite in this division.
The Cardinals, Will.
I've not actually seen – you'll have to forgive me. I don't have Baseball Reference open, so I'm not sure exactly what they did last year. But looking at their roster, they seem pretty good this year. They seem like a team to look out for. The Cubs, it's funny. I found myself – obviously, we'll get to the Cardinals in a moment, but, I think it's very obvious that the Cubs are the favorite of this division. And I find myself looking at the Cubs being like, okay, where are the weak spots? Where are the things that if I were a Cub fan, I would be worried about? Other than the fact that just, my inherent, evil. And the things that I find are really only two things. One, you have not to say that Fowler was like the linchpin of that defense, because he wasn't, but now you have to play Schwarber in left field all year. And that was obviously like the strength of the Cubs last year was their defense. In fact, Fangraphs had a good piece comparing actually the Cubs and Cardinals were actually pretty similar in batted balls, but the Cardinals defense was very terrible and the Cubs defense was so historically good. You're going to lose a little bit with Schwarber. Obviously, you have him hitting all year, but you are going to lose something having to play him in the field all year. And I'm not sure this, like obviously Lester, Arrieta, Hendricks, Lackey, there's a good pitch of this team. The bottom part of that rotation looks a little worrisome to me. Lackey, these guys are still old. If I'm squinting, I'm trying to find, that's where my little weak spots are, but nothing that gets me even close to thinking this division is not pretty easily theirs.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the Schwarber thing, and I think we've kind of forgotten that the Cubs fell into this whole max defense thing. I mean, this thing that I want to write about here in the next week or so. You know, Carl Schwarber was the left fielder to start last season, and he wasn't going to play a lot of catcher. He was going to mostly play left field. He got hurt, and that freed up 1,400 defensive innings that, by and large, went to better defensive players. They went to Baez. They went to Albert Amor. Not on a 1-for-1 ratio, but they got most of that playing time. Zobrist went to the outfield. Baez played second base. And the Schwarber injury helped create this max defense Cubs situation. I don't think if Schwarber is traipsing around left field for 1,000 or 1,200 innings, the Cubs are as good defensively as they were last year, and there's a different story about it. They probably would have scored more runs, and I think they still would have been a great team. But we would not have had this narrative. And I think not only in the return of, you know, putting Schwarber in the outfield, but I think the J.L. Moore decision in center is interesting because John Jay, who you're very familiar with, to me he's always seemed like a fourth outfielder, a tweener.
Yeah.
Not a true center fielder. Almora is a plus-plus center fielder, and if it was my team, Almora would be batting eighth or ninth, depending on where the pitcher is, and playing center field every day, and John Jay would be defensive replacement for Schwarber. That would literally be their roles for me. So I don't know how that's going to actually play out, but I think that if you all of a sudden go from Fowler, Zobrist, or Almora, that group of guys in center and left, to Schwarber and Jay, that's a lot of extra balls falling in. And I think the Cubs' run prevention is certainly going to take a hit this year. I have the same concerns you do about the pitching depth. I like Mike Montgomery a lot more as a reliever than a starter, and he's, I think, slotted as the five right now. Brett Anderson, who suffered two injuries while we've been talking here, is the number six. I don't even know who the number seven is. Carlos Zambrano?
Yeah, right.
Pretty much. They had incredible health last year. Those top four guys, when they missed starts, it was essentially voluntary. Like, they put Lackey on the DL because they had a 20-game lead. If they had a two-game lead, Lackey probably doesn't go on the DL in August. They were really – and I think they want to do that this year, but they don't have the depth. They want to be careful with these guys because the Cubs are one of those teams that know they're trying to play a seven-month season. And if you already know that in March, you really want to pull back the reins on your starters throughout the course of the year because you need to get those extra four starts in November. So, you know, we'll see what happens here. The run prevention, I think, is going to be substantially worse, but the offense could be better. Hayward can't be worse than he was last year, right? I mean,
theoretically,
please, right? Would it surprise you if Rizzo and Bryant were collectively a little bit better this year? I mean, they're young guys. They can rake. Addison Russell is one of my favorite players, who I think takes a step forward. I've compared him in the past to Barry Larkin. The nature of the game today is such that nobody's going to steal 50 bases the way Larkin did, but everything else about Russell to me screams Larkin. And when Larkin was Russell's age, he was. I think he'd only played like 55 major league games. He'd come up at the end of 86 or 87, I'm getting my years here, and he basically wasn't as good. Like I see in Russell a future MVP and a guy who takes a big step forward this year. I cannot talk enough about Addison Russell and how good a player he is. And because he hit 240, people kind of get lost as to how good, you know, we're still a batting average oriented society. But Russell is a star in the making. I had said, this might have been hyperbole, and if you want to call me out, fine, but I'm pretty sure I said at some point during this Cubs run-up that I would rather have Russell than Bryant. And I'm not entirely sure that's wrong. Russell's a couple years younger. He plays the better position. He's going to be a better defensive player. I'm honestly not sure Russell doesn't end up with a better career than Chris Bryant. That's how much I'm high on Chris Russell. Addison Russell. So I think the team's going to score a ton of runs, and they're going to win the division. Maybe not going away the way they did last year, but the only way this goes really sideways is if a couple of pitchers get hurt.
All right, so now I know obviously
you just skipped over that. You just don't even want to talk about the Cubs anymore.
I mean, I'm happy to talk about them moving forward. I honestly cannot get Baseball Reference to open, so I do not know. I need to find out what happened next year. I feel like lacking information and context to appropriately discuss the Cubs because I just can't get it open. I got some people I got to call over there. Or maybe I won't bother. Okay, so it's funny. You know, there is a sense that you've seen some of the projection systems this year have been very down on the Cardinals. And I to the point where I've heard it, like I've talked to people at Baseball Perspectives, and they're like, yeah, we're not sure why it's doing that either. We don't really believe it. I think they may just be saying that to appease me. But certainly, there's a sense, I think, among some people, the Cardinals are taking this big step back. To be entirely honest with you, I don't completely see it. I feel like part of that is because everyone was very excited about Alex Reyes. And when he got hurt, they're like, oh, the Cardinals are already, we're going to have trouble. Now they're in deep trouble. The Cardinals, like, there was already a discussion whether Reyes was even going to be the fifth starter this year. There was some discussion of even starting the year in Memphis or, like, being careful to have him be a bullpen option later in the year. They had not figured out, because they were worried, because he was also supposed to pitch for the Dominican team in the World Baseball Classic, so they weren't sure they were going to be able to fit him in. So the point is, obviously, you're not a better team if you lose Alex Reyes. However, the Cardinals did not have, it's like, it would hurt him more to lose him in 2019 than would lose to lose him in 2017. When I look at this team, to me, the key thing with Fowler is obviously, Fowler helps them out because he hit, like, definitely needed an OBP guy at the top. They needed a leadoff guy. They needed an OBP guy. They needed someone to just get the stick out of Matheny's arse in the clubhouse, to be entirely honest. It's been fun to watch Fowler just, like, charm the generally charmless and charm-free Matheny this spring training. So that's been fun. But what it really does, just on the field-wise and defensively, it's not that Fowler's a great defensive center fielder, but it puts Drano Grichik to left field, who is a much better left fielder than Matt Holliday, and Piscay's fine in right field. It fixed really what was the major problem with this team last year, which is defense. It fixed the outfield part. The infield part, to me, comes, do they trust Colton Wong? If they trust Colton Wong and let him play second base, another Matheny issue, to me, that shores up a lot of the infield defense because Aledmys Diaz was better throughout the season. So for me, a lot of the troubles that the Cardinals had last year, if you look at fielding independent pitching, Mike Leake was actually, had the same year Mike Leake always has. He just had a bad year peripherally because the defense was so bad. So I think the defense is better. I think the lineup is better. And I think the key guy for me is Michael Wacha. And I think if Wacha can be an okay fifth starter, I have to say this looks like a wild card team to me.
Lots to unpack there. I agree with you that the signing of Fowler should upgrade two defensive positions. And then I saw Matt Adams in left field.
Yeah, they're just farting around.
But that bothered, see, I didn't like the way they aligned the infield this winter. I thought moving Carpenter to first was a give up move. You're lessening the value of your team for the sake of Johnny Peralta. And Johnny Peralta is just not that good a player anymore. He's a 320, 400 hitter who isn't a shortstop anymore. He's playing third base. That's not a good player. And Peralta's actually historically been much worse defensively at third base. I mean, this is dating back to his time with the Indians when they played him at third for a year, but he's not a good defensive third baseman. I don't know why you don't keep Carpenter at third, Diaz and Wong up the middle, and play an Adams-Peralta platoon at first. And to me, I still like Matt Adams. I think Matt Adams can rake. I think this is a team that actually, with the loss of Holliday, with the addition of Fowler, could use just a raw 500 slugging type guy. And I really don't like the way they've handled this. And they've kind of buried Adams, and Adams in left field would just, yeah. I don't even have words.
He's literally playing there right now in the spring training game, as we discuss, and his first ground ball they gave to Randall Grichik to throw. So,
yeah, I mean, this is a bad idea. Yeah. And all for the sake of Johnny Peralta.
Right.
Joel Peralta's pitching for the no, it's Joel Pinheiro. Yes. See, I can't get these. I don't know anything about baseball now. I'm getting old. That's honestly what it is. I can't keep track of 1,400 names anymore. But I don't really like the way they handle it. So you talk about, and this is, you know, I'm a fan of the Cardinals front office. You know, I'm a fan of what they've done. I think they're one of the best run organizations in the game. But I didn't like the way they handled it. So it contributes to the sense of maybe they're not going to get it done this year. Losing Reyes, I know you're trying to minimize it. Yeah, he would have started the year, would have been managed innings, but even 130 innings of Alex Reyes this year would have been an enormous boost. This guy was a power arm. If it's 50 in the bullpen and then 12 starts or something, I mean, that helps you tremendously. Plus, it's having him in the postseason when presumably you've managed his innings in a way that allows you to make him your number two starter in the postseason. The last thing you said before you turned it over to me was about Michael Wacha, and I just don't believe in Michael Wacha anymore. I don't think the shoulder So you've got Lance Lynn coming off an injury. You've got Michael Wacha in the five spot, who hasn't really been an effective starter in 2.5 years now, healthy and effective in 2.5 years. Luke Weaver.
Yes.
I mean, it really thins out at the back. And, you know, we're talking about the Cubs having the same problem. I'll take Martinez, Wainwright, Leak, but I still got to get 60 other starts out of guys. So there's some concern there. I think they can score runs. I think if they can get out of their own way in terms of playing the right guys, I have them at the top of the wild card heap right now. But there's, again, a fair amount of variance here based on who plays and what they get at the back of the rotation.
It's funny, and this is...
And the manager, the manager penalty.
Yeah, the manager is an issue. I may have mentioned this
podcast. There's literally a manager penalty built into my numbers from the team.
It's understandable. And the last thing, because I'm going to have a follow-up on St. Louis, but I'm curious what I think one of the big aspects of intrigue for the Cardinals is, because Peralta is scheduled to play third now, but also they see Jed Jerko as like a... like to kind of bounce around and play all of those positions. To me, the real issue is what's interesting about the Carpenter move is I think it was actually made. It was made ostensibly for defense, but it was really made for moving forward. Like Peralta is a free agent after this year. He's not signing with the Cardinals for 2018. Everybody knows that. So, and I don't think they consider Jerko that person either. Like third base is. Like, that's the intriguing position for the Cardinals. Like, that, like the, to me, the thing with the Cardinals that I think that they are is they are a team built to be a fantastic team that's complementary to a big superstar. They just don't have that big superstar.
And that guy's not going to be on the market next year.
Yes, yeah. But, I mean, they're hoping for a year after. I think that we'll see what happens. But, yes, I think you're right. Okay, so next up I have the Pirates. The Pirates are interesting to me. Last year they took a little bit of a step back. But you know, there's still a lot of young talent here. They seem to have the Andrew McCutchen thing still seems to not be resolved. I'm curious how that works moving forward. You know, you can make an argument McCutchen's a dude that should have a statue of himself outside of PNC Park. You should also make an argument that they should have traded him last year. So, what do you think of not only McCutchen but the Pirates moving forward?
Well, the problem was the statue of McCutchen was playing center
field. Yes, and now it's playing right field. Yes.
It's not unfair to align your outfield. Ultimately, I think this is a good move for the team. I understand moving him to. I would have kept Polanco in right, but if you're playing 81 games at home, PNC Park is actually easier for a right fielder than a left fielder. So I kind of understand, especially when it's odd. McCutchen has a bad arm, so you want him playing in the shorter outfield. But third base is still in the same place, as far as I know. So yes. Kind of an odd choice there, but they're going with it. I don't think that's their problem. I think their problem is the rotation. I love Gerrit Cole. I think he can be a legit number one, but then what are they going to get out of Taillon? What are they going to get out of Glasnow? Chad Kuhl, Ivan Nova, who I literally watched him at the stadium 2 weeks before he was traded, and he looked like release bait, and then he got a 3-year deal in the offseason. I think they're going to give up a ton of runs. You know, one of the big stories this spring is Tony Watson's been terrible. Not that you have to worry too much about spring training, but it does underline the fact that Watson seemingly be to Peter Principle his way into the closer role. This bullpen, which has been good in the past, they signed Daniel Hudson off of, you know, what was he good for, 6 weeks last year. I like Felipe Rivero, who they got from Melanson, but this pitching staff I think is problematic. And I could see the Pirates playing an awful lot of 7-6 games this year.
All right, then we have the last two teams of division. We can probably wrap them up a little bit in one spot. Though I will say one thing I think is interesting. I wrote this in my review, in my preview for Sports North, is the Brewers to me look a lot more interesting than the Reds. If just because they kind of, A, they've got this really nice farm system, but B, they seem to have a clearer plan. They seem to have a clearer idea of what they're trying to do. And one, I almost find the Brewers, like, obviously they're a part of this Reds, Padres, Phillies kind of, you know, Braves kind of figure it out tank situation, but they seem farther along in that, almost to the point that you can see them. I remember the 2014 Cubs, that last month and a half a year, you're like, uh-oh, here they come. And that they were still not the Cardinals were still a better team. I think the Pirates were still a better team. But you could clearly see, okay, this scary thing is coming. For me, the team that of all of those teams in that part of the contention carousel, I think the Brewers are the one that could at least start seeing a little bit of that noise happening, at least at the end of this year.
Yeah, I mean, this got lost in the trade deadline that Brian Cashman had last year. But, I mean, David Stearns did a phenomenal job. And they've really done a good thing. In the Gomez and LaCroix trades, they really stacked the farm system. They've drafted well. Yeah, they've got a kid named Ison Diaz who I don't even remember. Oh, the Gene Segura trade got them Ison Diaz. This is a loaded farm system. They had the you have to get those trades right. The Cubs got Kyle Hendricks for Ryan Dempster. You have to get those trades right. And the Brewers have done a great job. They drafted well. I love the fact that they got Corey Ray in the draft last year. I'm very, very high on him. So this is one of the best farm systems in the game now. They're also doing some fun stuff. I mean, whether so, I don't believe the Eric Thames signing is going to work out, but going to Korea and getting a guy who flamed out here and then hit in Korea for 3 years is innovative. Signing in a Jesus Aguiar. They're going to have to build a pitching staff, and that's going to take some time. But offensively, they've done some really interesting stuff. And they're like the American League version, the National League version of the Twins, where they're not going to be good, but they're going to be watchable.
And then we have the Reds. And the Reds seem to me farther away than some of these other teams in that convention, in that contention carousel idea. They and maybe that's hanging on to Votto. Well, of course, I can you can understand why they do that. There's been some good arguments as to why they've hung on to Votto. But this, you know, I think the Reds fear one of these days, one of these teams is going to go through a tanking cycle and never actually get good. Like we've seen the Astros and Cubs do it. And maybe they get better and maybe they improve, but they don't get... Like right now, the Astros and Cubs have had a ton of success so far doing this. But there are enough teams doing this now that... Eventually, they can't all win the World Series. Some of them are going to fall short. If I had to pick one that would be most worried about doing it, I have to say it might be the Reds.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You talk about the trade, trading your veterans and getting value back. The Reds basically got air for Todd Frazier, Aroldis Chapman, and Brandon Phillips. And that's one of the reasons they're in this position right now. They just didn't restock the farm system. You mentioned Votto. They're stuck. Votto has a no trade. Votto can't go anywhere. If Votto doesn't want to go anywhere, Votto's not going to go. And we've lost the value part of that contract too. It's all 25. It's $25 million a year to the Rapture now. So there were some cheap years there they could have traded. Those are gone. So it's a tough spot. And you know they invested their money in Homer Bailey, who's thrown like nine innings since they signed the six-year contract. So a lot of things have gone wrong. I mean, there's some talent here. Amir Garrett's getting a lot of buzz. The former St. John's power forward is now a pitcher for them.
Yeah.
But you know, it's, they need everything to go right. So this is. You look at the five-year window and say, who are the teams in baseball right now who are the worst positioned for the next 5 years? The Reds are in that group along with the Padres and the A's.
All right, so now we will move over to the American League East as we'll wrap up with the often overlooked AL East. And it's funny because you know I always bring this up with the Red Sox, but I joked about this earlier, but this is – I wonder if this is the strategy down the line. It's like hire someone young and ambitious who just wants to build and build and build and then fire them and have someone that's really good at trading or at least really proficient at trading come in and supplement the team. Because I have to say, as much as I'm sure it hurt to trade Moncada and hurt to trade some of these guys, yeah, you know, the Red Sox look like they have that combination of top-shelf veteran talent and top-shelf young talent that could be pretty scary.
I saw Ben Cherington gets a ring when this team wins something because it's his team. I didn't really like that sequence. I look at Dave Dombrowski has had a tremendous career in the game, and he's been one of the best GMs, and he's probably qualified for the Hall of Fame. But this whole last 14 months with the Red Sox has been very awkward, where it's just the guy who comes in and just takes everything you've built and gives it away. And some of these deals were – I mean, trading for Chris Sale is you're getting one of the best pitchers in the game. That's fine. But when you trade Anderson Espinosa for – even at the moment was not going to be a trade you were going to win for Drew Pomeranz, you really have to question that. So we'll see how it works out. I mean, there's a lot of – the Red Sox are clearly the favorite in a division. You mentioned the overcover at AL East. This is not the AL East of, you know, a few years back. The Yankees, Orioles, and Blue Jays are all kind of middling teams now. We'll talk about the other one in a second. But this is clearly the best team in the division. But it's not the best team in the league. I would take the Indians over the Red Sox. Even if you tell me David Price is going to pitch a full season, I would take the Indians over the Red Sox right now.
Okay, and what's interesting is when you look at my second place team, it's really kind of amazing. Of all the reasons to hate the Yankees, to me, one of the best ones is...
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, sorry. Listen, I'm a Cardinals fan, okay? I'm now part of the being hated club. We've all made our peace with it. The idea that they have gone through as much upheaval and disappointment as the Yankees ever go through, and they've rebuilt the farm system, and there's all these young, exciting players coming in, and they still never had a losing season. Like, that is unbelievable that they still never had a losing season. They make all those trades, and they get hot in August. Obviously the Yankees do have a lot of young talent, but there's also, because this being New York and this being the Yankees, there's like Gary Sanchez is not actually better than Mike Trout. Like, there's a sense that like all these guys are ready to mature and be great right now. Should we pump the brakes a little bit on the Yankees? Because to me, I feel like I like to bet on young teams and bet on young talent. Even if you maybe pump the brakes a little bit on someone like Sanchez, is there still, how many, can they at least, I know this isn't necessarily the year they want to contend, but can they contend this year before they really ultimately just take over?
Contend is a strong word. Can they be part of that wild card mix again? Sure. I mean, this has been kind of the Yankees ceiling for a few years now. 87 wins and a spot in the wild card game, and then see what happens after that. One of the things that the $200 million payroll does is it gives you a high floor. When you have, you know, two win players like Ellsbury and Gardner and Headley and guys like that, you're just only going – there's only so bad you can be. You're filling most spots with major league players. You've got Tanaka in the rotation. You've got Aroldis Chapman in the bullpen. So you're just not going to be that bad. Once you, if your floor is 75 wins, it doesn't take a whole lot above that to get to be in the low 80s, which is where the Yankees have, I think, been for 5 years in a row now, 6 years in a row now. Joe Girardi does manage a bullpen. He's frustrated me over the years, but I have to admit, he's actually a good manager of these relievers. The Yankees have turned up some talent. You mentioned Sanchez last year. You know, turning Dylan Betances into a great reliever has worked out. We'll see this year. Bird's going to be the first baseman. Judge is going to be the right fielder. A lot of this year's team is going to be about these young players. But you know, it's an unexciting team to watch. At least we're getting some of the young players in now. But again, it's a lot of these Ellsbury, Headley, Castro. It's like these second and third tier guys who came up in other organizations. And it'll be more fun to watch this year because of the young talent. But the last couple of Yankee teams, they were hard to get behind because they were this kind of mishmash of other people's talent. So the core 4 years are gone. It's been 6 years since the Yankees have won the division title. Now it's really about getting to next year, getting to the young talent, getting to the Gleyber Torres era. And this is a bridge team. But again, the floor is just so high that they're just not going to be that bad.
Okay, obviously, but the fact that I have the Yankees second, I'm down on the Blue Jays, who I have third. It's funny how recently the Blue Jays felt like a super team. Right? Remember when they traded for Price? They're like, wow, mm-hmm. This was like a super team. And it feels like... And again, I don't think this is going to be a terrible team or anything, but you just can't help but feel that the Blue Jays, they just missed it. Like they've really come so close the last couple of years. This not that losing Encarnacion is somehow dooming to them, but I'm not sure. I don't see how Morales is enough of a fill-in for him. You really are kind of wish-casting for Bautista to make this big comeback for them to have close to the offense that they did last year. And their strength last year was pitching, and it feels like a lot of things fell right for them last year in that regard. Am I too low on Toronto?
No, I'm right there with you. It's like they peaked. They had their two-year peak, and now they're going to slip back. They quietly become kind of an old team, re-signing Bautista, you know, going out and getting Morales. Tulowitzki is 32. Josh Donaldson, even. You know, I want to say Josh Donaldson's 30 now. I mean, this is, you know, quietly an older team. We'll see if the offense can hold with the loss of Encarnacion. A lot of health issues. You know, is Devin Travis finally going to have a healthy season? What are they going to get out of Bautista? Troy Tulowitzki is always a health issue. Not a lot of internal depth. Their pitching last year was phenomenal. And Marcus Stroman is basically the pitching version of Addison Russell for me. I just love the guy. I shouldn't. He's 5'3", and short right-handers just don't have a good track record, but I love him. We'll see if Aaron Sanchez, who was a great surprise last year, can hold that for a second season. I think the real key is going to be the two kind of on-contact guys from last year, Estrada and Happ. And there was a lot of talk last year about their performances on batted balls. I think you have to project some regression into their numbers. They're not going to hold that note. That's going to cause some extra runs to fall. They're going to give up some extra runs. Again, it's they're in that 80 to 83 win range. I think it's a fairly narrow band for them. And I see more downside risk with injuries and age with the offense than I do upside. I'm not sure who you can project on the Blue Jays to necessarily be better than they were last year. Maybe Stroman.
Okay, so I think I know who your surprise team is, but we're not necessarily there yet because I still have in fourth place. I have the Orioles, and it's funny. I have a friend in town who's a big Orioles fan, and it reminded me, we've talked about something that I thought that Jake Mintz from Success Family Barbecue wrote a really good essay in Baseball Prospectus annual about this idea that the thing that was keeping the Orioles, the magic that you thought was like keeping them afloat above all the projections, was this idea of not only Buck Showalter, but Buck Showalter managing the bullpen and handling all that and having that kind of pixie dust he was able to pull off. And then at the key possible moment, he makes a massive bullpen blunder that you would expect of a Mike Matheny to name a random name out of the sky. So I'm curious. Like, and so there's a theory I know among some fans that like that made everything go poof, and this is when it's all going to fall off the table. Not putting aside the theory that specific moment made everything go poof, do you think everything goes poof for the Orioles this year?
It's funny because I think they did some things that actually helped them. They've been this high slugging, low OBP offense for so long. Like bringing in a Seth Smith actually kind of moves that along for them. Somebody who can hit that high, they haven't had a leadoff hitter in forever. You get that high in the lineup and get on base for all their slugging guys. I never would have re-signed Mark Trumbo, but given the deal they finally gave him, it's hard to be too upset about it. Was it 3-40? I just talk about the magic. One of the things that doesn't get talked enough with the Orioles is the infield defense. Davis, Scope, Hardy, and Machado is as good as it gets across four positions, and that's been a big part of their success. Unfortunately, the outfield is Adam Jones, who's last week's catch notwithstanding, is really a corner outfielder playing center at this point in his career. Smith is not a good outfielder. Hyun-Soo Kim is not a good outfielder. Mark Trumbo is very not a good outfielder. They've got Craig Gentry, but he's just not going to play a whole lot. They're talking about playing Pedro Alvarez out there. I mean, it's
that's
the tribute.
Matt Adams.
Yeah. It's the tribute to Triple's outfield. I don't trust the staff at all. I know Dylan Bundy got some good pub last year. He had a decent run, but there's no evidence he can throw 150 innings. Literally no evidence he can throw 150 innings in a season. Tillman's already hurt to start the year. So it's Gausman and Ubaldo Jimenez and Wade Miley. I cannot see them preventing enough runs to contend. I think this could blow up. If anything goes wrong in the bullpen, if they just happen to have an off year in the bullpen where they don't find the random Brad Brock to come in and give them 100 good innings or 80 good innings, whatever it was, the run prevention can go south in a hurry. I think I've been under on the Orioles for 4 years now, and they've proved me wrong, most of that time. But it's the blackjack player. I know it stinks to hit on 16 against the 10 every time, but you have to do it.
Fair enough. And then we have I have without much confidence. Have the Rays last in the division, not because of their rotation, which I think it may very well be the best in the division. I have a hard time seeing how they score too many runs. They're obviously a good defensive team, but this, even if whether you're up on the Rays or down on the Rays, it's a team that seems like it's going to have to win a lot of 3-2 games.
Yeah, again, and this is the thing, if they can just put a league average offense on the field, and I'm just not sure they can do it. I mean, they've taken these chances. It seems like guys go there and their bat dives. You look at a Corey Dickerson, you look at a Steven Souza. Those guys just haven't developed. Brad Miller was the exception last year. I looked up in August, he had 22. It was one of those things where you just don't pay attention to a player, and he has 22 home runs in August.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Yeah.
I like the trade. I think getting Matt Duffy for Matt Moore was an interesting pickup. I think Duffy could be a plus shortstop for them. Longoria had a bounce back year last year. We'll see if he can continue that. I love the pitching. They could be one of the best run prevention teams in the league. And if you're the best at either scoring or preventing runs, that's a start to them. I have them as the second best team in that division. Awesome. I have them pushing for the wild card. But I've been on the Rays. Was it last year that Prospectus had them winning like 92 games?
Yeah.
So I'm going to be the idiot this year. We're going to leave the old company. The old company was the idiot last year. I'm going to be the idiot about the Rays this year. But I absolutely see all of the downsides. I trust the pitching. Which I think, and it's not even just the five guys that they have in rotation now. Brent Honeywell, Jose De Leon, they have depth. Like, they have seven starters better than anybody the Padres have. So we'll see how it goes.
All right, so now we will go. We will wrap up with the National League East. I have the Nationals winning this division, and frankly, I'm kind of surprised not everybody does, and maybe we'll talk about
that
more.
Thank you.
Like, we'll talk about that maybe a little more when we get to the Mets. But to me, I don't see, like, yes, maybe Scherzer pitched today in spring training and looked fine, so, you know, there doesn't seem to be too much worry. I can see potential worry there if there's a health issue, but, like, Tanner Roark is really good. Like, he's got, like, Illinois, go Illini.
He's the best pitcher America can produce.
Exactly. That's what we produce here in Champaign, Illinois. So, to me, that rotation, it doesn't have that superstar rotation that they once had. But to me, getting a full season of Turner just transforms that whole lineup, even before you bring in Adam Eaton there. I just think this is the best team in the division by a lot.
I don't think it's close. And some of that is me being down on the Mets, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, any kind of bounce back from Harper, the upgrades, Eaton over Taylor, Turner over Espinoza, Anthony Rendon, I'm still a big fan of. If Lind platoons with Zimmerman, that's a huge upgrade because Ryan Zimmerman can't hit right-handed breaking stuff anymore. I love what they did this winter. And, you know, they paid a lot. They paid very expensive prices. I think you could argue against what they paid, but they made their current team a lot better. And Mike Rizzo, if he needs to get a starter at the deadline, still has Oscar Robles. And at this point, I think you look at the Nationals and say, they don't care about 2018 at this point. They've got, 2019. They've got two more years with Harper. They're going to do whatever they can to try to win a World Series with Harper. So if you can put a Robles out there at the deadline, you can go out and get another starting pitcher. So I think this is going to be a very good team. The bullpen is the biggest concern. There's an element of me that wants to say they're going to be up 6-1 in the eighth so often. The bullpen's not going to matter that much, but, you know, this is something you could see them improve as the offseason goes on. They've got a kid named Coda Glover who could end up being the closer. It's just a lot of these interchangeable right-handed relievers. But I look at the two younger guys, and Glover and Solis might be the two best pitchers. So, no, I'm with you. I think this is a 93-win team, and I don't think anybody else in the division is going to be within 7 games.
Awesome. Well, that brings us to the Mets. And I understand why people dream on the Mets. I understand how everybody, if everything falls perfectly in that rotation, the way everybody wants it to fall perfectly in that rotation, maybe. But A, I don't think that's going to happen. B, even if it does, this team, I'm sorry, but this team looks like one that has Cespedes, who has clearly taken big step forwards. I remember that it was only a couple years ago when everyone was a little down on Cespedes. I think he's clearly stepped up and become one of those top-tier players. But I just don't see a lot else in this lineup that to be able to withstand any sort of dip in the pitching.
Last year, I had the Mets winning 103 games because I bought into the pitching staff, and the top five guys, the five young guns, made 93 starts. And they still won 80-something games because Bartolo Colon was good and the offense was better than expected. But I look at this team and I go, okay, it's the same core of young stars. Now, I'm going to run through it. Syndergaard had an elbow scare last year, and based on his velocity, he basically projects to blow out his elbow. Jacob DeGrom, 140-some-odd innings before being shut down. Matt Harvey, thoracic outlet syndrome. Steven Matz has never thrown 150 innings in a season. How much are you going to project these guys to make 32 starts? And so let's say that they get the same pitching they did last year, which I think is roughly what they might get. I don't know that you can project Robert Selman to be any better than Bartolo Colon was for them last year. They've run back the same offense that I literally listened to Met fans complain about for 3 months at the end of last year. It is a no walk, no singles, no. All they do is hit home runs. Last year they had the third highest, it's a little nerdy, rate of runs scored on home runs. They scored more than half of their runs on home runs. It was the only thing they did well offensively, and they literally brought back everybody. At what position are the Mets going to be better this year than they were last year? Walker, Cabrera, Cespedes, Granderson, these guys all had years at the top of their range. They buried Conforto again, and we could do an entire podcast on the Michael Conforto saga. Jose Reyes is going to be the third baseman because David Wright can't get on the field. They're counting on Duda, who can't stay healthy. They can't counting on Darno, that can't stay healthy. I don't know where you look at this team and say they're actually going to be better offensively than they were last year. They were 11th in the league in runs last year. I had Met fans say, well, it was sequencing and they didn't hit with the runners in scoring position. That's part of it, but you didn't hit with runners in scoring position because the only thing you did offensively was hit home runs. You didn't hit doubles. You didn't hit singles as an offense. You literally only hit home runs. So there's no sequencing matters when you're hitting a bunch of things and they're just not happening in the right order. But if all you're doing is hitting home runs and making outs, you really can't complain about sequencing. So I don't understand the people who think the Mets are as good as the Nationals. The early over-unders came out. I did a thing 5 weeks ago when they came out, and the Mets were like at 89.5, which was literally a go to JFK, get on a flight, fly out to whatever the Imperial Palace is called these days. And I am probably the low man on the Mets. People think I hate the Mets. I don't. That stems from being critical of the ownership and their penury over the after the Mata thing and how they were running a small market budget in New York. I don't have that level of disdain for the front office anymore. I think they're spending money. I just don't think the baseball team is very good.
Yeah, okay. Well, you and I are definitely on the same page there. And then we have the other days. I actually am low also on Miami because my third place team is Atlanta. I have Atlanta third, but not necessarily in a good way, if that makes sense. For me, it's funny, you talk about frustrations with front offices and front offices to kind of yell at. To me, I think you can make an argument that the Braves are in the bottom five of ownership groups in all of baseball and are frankly kind of loathsome people, to be entirely honest with you. If you see what they've done with those minor league teams and how, like, I think the city that the Mississippi Braves are in pays like 15% of their GDP to pay taxes on the stadium that they're going to leave in 10 years. Like, it's just gross what the Braves have done. But because they're opening the stadium this year, I think arguably that mistakenly are trying to put a potentially 500 team on the field this year. And so, therefore, that's why they bring in R.A. Dickey. They probably bring in Colon. Why they bring in Jaime Garcia. I think they've made a league average offense and a league average pitching staff, which is better than I think they even need to be bothering with right now. But because they have that stadium, I feel like they feel like they have to. So I think the Braves are going to be better than most people think they are and better than necessarily what is necessarily good for them.
I agree with you in all of that, except that I think they're just a little bit worse than you're saying in terms of league average. So yeah, they've set themselves a very high floor. They set this as a higher floor than you would expect for a team at this point in its development because of Kemp and Phillips and Marquez and guys like that. So yeah, I think they're better than the true rebuilding team in Philly. And I'll be honest with you, you got to admit, they might even be better than the Marlins. I might be just too high on the Marlins. But yeah, I don't think if you told me none of the other three teams finished over 500, I'd be right there with you.
And it's funny because it's still, you think like this season would just be about like, okay, let's see what Swanson's like and let's work in some of these younger pitchers. Mm-hmm. But it does. It feels like it's a decision like many decisions that this franchise makes that's so much less about baseball and more about the financial aspect of it.
And also, too, I look at the decisions to keep Freeman and to build around Freeman and to keep Terror on, at least so far. It's like you can't half-ass a rebuild. Either get rid of all of your players and bring in the guys who are going to be here when you're good again, or try to build around what was a couple of years ago, Simmons, Terron, Freeman, a couple of other guys I'm forgetting. But they've kind of done it half-assed, and that's how you end up winning 75 games for 10 years.
All right, so then we go to the Marlins. I mentioned this earlier, but the thing that we always kind of talked about with the Marlins was, like, when you had someone like Stanton and you had someone like Fernandez, all you needed was the rest of the roster to just be average, and you were a wild card contender. Obviously, with the loss of Fernandez, it feels like I'm gonna think of Fernandez every time I look at the Marlins for like the next 15 years. Like, it just feels like he was such a basis of, every fifth day the Marlins were like one of the best shows in baseball, and that's now gone. And obviously it's a tragedy, but it's like a tragedy in life. But for baseball, it really feels like there's something now. Like, I understand they tried to throw innings at the problem in the offseason, bring in Straley and bring in Volquez. But to me, like, listen, Yelich is an exciting player. There's some stuff here. But this looks like a team that already didn't have a lot of margin for error and has lost now not just its best pitcher, but kind of its soul.
Yeah, the Marlins are a hard organization to feel sympathy for because of the ownership and how they've been run for 20 years. But there's no question that the death of Jose Fernandez, a personal tragedy for the people who knew him and an organizational tragedy because it does. It's awkward to talk about the baseball, but eventually you have to. And losing a 6-win pitcher who was affordable for the next couple of years, it alters the course of the franchise. And the only comp I can come up with, and this is probably a bad one, is Len Bias. It's when you lose a talent at that level. I guess I'm not. I don't really remember if Lyman Bostock was that good. But thinking about like great players, great athletes who have died and altered the course of franchises, and I don't know how the Marlins recover from this. I think that it could be, from a baseball standpoint, they're just not good enough anymore. And from a organizational standpoint, this colors everything you do for a couple of years. So it's tough, and obviously sympathetic. And I think we've both written a lot about Fernandez and the joy he brought to the game. Obviously, the story is more complicated than that when it comes to the events of last September. But from a baseball standpoint, you just can't see this team contending.
All right, then that brings us to the last place team here, which are the Phillies. It's funny, because I think the Phillies are going to be a lot worse than the Braves, but I would totally bet on the Phillies' upside over the next 3 or 4 years than I would the Braves, not just because there's talent there. In fact, I think the Braves may actually have a little bit more, at least young talent. But to me, the Phillies, we've seen that they will spend. And with all of these big free agents going to be coming out, not next year, but in the next 3 or 4 years, it's hard to imagine the Phillies not getting, not doing everything in their power to get one or two of the, or even two of those guys. I think the Phillies are, they're still kind of figuring out what they've got, and they're still kind of in the early stages, really, of filtering everything out. I would bet on the Phillies moving forward over the Braves, but they still look like a last place team to me.
Yeah, and they made a couple moves this winter that kind of felt like keep the union off our backs moves, yeah. Trading for Kendrick and signing Michael Saunders. I'd rather see them just play Aaron Alter and Roman Quinn, play all the young players and see what you have. You've established the payroll at a certain level. Don't they actually play Howie Kendrick. The idea that you would trade for Howie Kendrick and play him left field makes me think you just didn't watch any baseball at all last year. But yeah, this and it's not a terrible team. You mentioned figuring out what they have. What is Vincent Velasquez? Is Aaron Nola going to be able to throw 200 innings a year at the major league level? Is Michael Franco going to be a middle of the order hitter? I think there's more questions than there are answers at this point. But in 2 years, this will be a fun team to watch. And as you say, the gap between their actual payroll and their potential payroll, literally you can fit 3 superstars in there. Yeah, so we'll see in a couple of years if they sign those guys.
I mean, you could fit several franchises in there. You could fit several teams' payrolls right in that gap. Joe, well, we went long. We always go long, but I have had an absolute blast as always. It's hard for me to get more excited for the baseball season than I am already, but this is always the thing that pushes me right there. I have had a wonderful time with you, as always. So thank you for making this podcast as much fun as I've come to expect it to be.
Ton of fun this year, Will. Hey, let's try to get to a game again this year. That was a lot of fun last year.
We saw a great highlight
of the year.
We saw a great game last year. We saw that it was that Mets game. It was that Mets game where Yadier Molina had that huge hit off Familia.
And what happened before that was I got to watch you literally melt down as Mike went full Matheny.
Oh, he did. He went
2 innings before that.
Oh, that was a full on Matheny.
Hey, but they won the game.
It's a learning curve. It's a learning curve. So, so just to let everybody know, because I tell people all the time to literally almost in every baseball piece I write to go subscribe to the Joe Sheehan baseball newsletter. But just tell people the easiest way to do that and the easiest way to find your stuff.
For everything for me at Joe_Sheehan on Twitter. The newsletter has a Facebook page. That's the best way to get information. You can also read excerpts about the newsletter from the newsletter there. Facebook.com/Sheehan newsletter. Those are the two best places to get all the information. I also want to mention this week the SI baseball preview, where depending on where you are, Chris Bryant or the Red Sox outfielders might be on the cover. A lot of great stuff in there. Tom Verducci did some great work. Emma Spann did a wonderful job putting that together. I've got a lot of material in there with proposals for every single team. So hope people will pick that up this week.
I will. I always reserve a meal in late March every year to sit down and read that issue all the way through. And I've been doing so for more years than I would like to admit. So it's always exciting to have you on there. So make sure to follow Joe. Thank you, Joe, for doing this. It's a blast. Let's go watch some baseball.
Sounds good. We'll take care.
All right. So everyone, so please, everyone, thank you. We'll be back next week with our regularly scheduled podcast. Enjoy everything else. Enjoy the season. The season is about to start. That is very exciting. As always, the music is by the Sundogs. We're going to have a new Sundogs song on this podcast soon. So if you've been listening to this song for the last 4 years, there's about to be a new Sundogs song to start the show. But please rate us on iTunes. Otherwise, have a great week, everyone. Enjoy. Bye.